I pumped up.
Have you had a nice cup of tea?
I have had two Earl Greys.
Okay, so you must be pumped up by now.
Oh, I am. I mean, nothing gets more pumped up than a cup of Earl Grey.
Yes, that's true. Or actually, a coffee does it better, but I know you guys don't drink it.
I know, I drink a lot of coffee.
Oh, okay.
That's my tube coping mechanism rather than what I drink on a weekend.
Oh, right, I see. Okay. Anyway, shall we?
Right. Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, look.
Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Bagel Podcast for what's boiling up around the Jewish community. I'm Hayden Cohen, and I'm here to be like King Solomon and give everyone from across the Jewish community a voice and a fair hearing. Or maybe it's more like Judge Judy. Same difference. Before I launch into what's coming up, I'd just like to ask a quick favour. If you've been listening and thinking, you know what, I've got a friend who may really like this, please tell them. It helps tons. The easiest place to point them towards is bagelpodcast.com, which includes any and every way to listen. Plus, there's a mailing list sign up, which will have some more prizes very, very soon. If you're feeling especially friendly, a review on iTunes or a recommendation on the Bagel Podcast Facebook page will be even more appreciated. Promo over, let's get on with it. On this week's show, we have Julia Gazdag talking about going on holiday with two mums. Clive Lawton tells us all about Ben Azai. Don't worry, I didn't know who he was either. You'll hear about the JQ Wingate Literary Prize, and there's a bagel bruigus on whether we should air our dirty linen in public, featuring Board of Deputies President Marie van der Zyl, Ben Crown, and Clive Lawton again, because you can't get too much Clive, or maybe you can, I don't know. But first up is Denise Phillips discussing challah, our Friday night ceremonial bread for all our honorary Gentiles listening, in honour of the challah bake for Shabbat UK. My dad actually made some, and it was surprisingly great. There was no indigestion, and my mum was very jealous. Fun for all the family. Anyway, here's Denise.
So I'm here with Denise Phillips. We're going to be talking about Shabbat UK and cooking for Shabbos.
Well, this year, I say, it's been changed. Shabbat UK is the weekend or the 1st and 2nd of March. So it's a different type of season from when we were celebrating it before. But what's still happening, which is great, is the challah bake. And I love making challah. I make it every single week. It's my contribution of many, but to make Shabbat special, and you can't beat homemade. So, but the meaning of challah comes from the biblical requirement, hafrashnat challah, which means to separate and to take. And in other words, so when we take challah, we're actually making a difference. We're taking something with us on this spiritual journey of this, you know, the 25 hours of Shabbos. And challah also means to dance and round in circles. So many of our challahs are also round, but they're also round different times of the year. So on Rosh Hashanah, we have round challah to celebrate the circle of life. We also have challah where we have the different number of plats. And this is fun. I mean, God, how many? Three plats, four, five, six. But sometimes we even have 12. And this, you know, what do we need to do that for? I mean, three is good, but there's also a little bit of symbolism attached to this. So if you've got 12 strands of...
Well, can I guess? 12 shrines.
Well, of course, the 12 shrines. But also the 12 loaves, which is the showbread as well, which is, you know, something to remember.
So the showbread?
Yes, you have that in the temple. They have the showbread.
I thought you were going to say we have it in the Great British Bake Off.
No, we don't. But often you use the three. It could be the three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, or the 3 foot festivals, Pesach, Shavuot and Sukkot. But how do you make it? You know, this is what we're all about, and it's about twisting and getting them equal. But I make them perfect, and of course you want a perfect challah, is if you weigh up your bread and you divide the number of the brands, at least they will all be equal size. And so it will look perfect from the looking at it, as well as it's going to taste great. But you can...
Isn't there something nice, though, about, like, homemade challah, the fact that it isn't perfect, isn't that... It just gives you that kind of legitimacy that you know it's homemade, or am I just... Am I uncouth? Is that the...
No. I mean, you want to make it look as professional as you want. But I vary the ingredients quite often. You know, the same when you go to a shop, it's this the bog standard or the same one you know each week. But sometimes that's a good thing. You know what you're going to get. You bought and this is what it's going to taste like. But I will change the different types of flour. So whether I'll put spelt flour in, which gives it a really light texture, or I'll put a wholemeal or a multigrain, and I'll flavour it with cinnamon, or I'll put in different toppings, whether it's pumpkin seeds, sesame seeds, sunflower seeds, to give it a different appearance. And I'll make little individual ones sometimes as well, so that each person has got their own little challah as well as the large one to cut. Or I shape the challah so that you could put your napkin through it as well, which is quite cute. So the variation.
Oh, I like that. I might steal that idea. Thank you.
Yes. So much you can do with challahs in addition to the shapes. So you can make them into the shape of when it's Shavuos and it will look like the tablets, you know, of stone. You can do that element as well. But having made your challah on Friday night, the question is, do we put salt on the bread or not? There is a complete debate because we obviously don't have the temple now, and that's the reason why, according to Jewish law, salting challah is a critical component of making hamotzi.
Well, but, of course, I'm in the first year of marriage, so I'm putting honey, yeah.
You see, it's a nice little thing to remember.
And in fact, he was my best man. He still puts honey on because he goes, what's the message that after a year everything's salty? He refuses, still puts honey on.
Oh, it's quite a cute thing. So salt plays an indispensable role in Jewish life, dating back to biblical times and ancient Israel. But it is a preservative, and salt represents the food of Hashem and required for the sacrifices at the temple. And a dining table is symbolic of an altar. So if the three opinions in my household, sprinkle with salt or symbolic no temple, according to others, there is no temple, so no longer needed to put salt on, is the question. But
I've never heard that before. Seriously, I've never heard the no salt thing.
Yeah, so some people, no temple, no longer perform sacrifices. There's no sacrifices. So should not be sprinkled with salt, but dipped into it. So dip in instead of sprinkle, dip. So there's three views: no temple, no sacrifice, no salt. You ask a Jewish person or the sages, they'll give you three opinions and their own and an argument discussion. But whatever it is, it's symbolism and it's eating something that's meaningful, which is lovely.
And it's bread, and who doesn't like bread?
Oh, this is it. So on Purim, again, the festival time, we have different types of challah. The template, you know, the plaiting representing Haman and his sons. You could coat it in poppy seeds, hundreds and thousands. So again, it's an opportunity to be meaningful with the bread that we eat. As Simcha Rosh Hashanah and Simchas Torah, we dip, say, have round, as I mentioned, dipping it into honey. And also after Pesach, the first Shabbos after Pesach, there is a custom to make a key shaped in challah called sugala, meaning treasure or livelihood. And this is a real Sephardi tradition. Have you heard about this one?
No. Key.
This was the time when the Jews entered the Holy Land and manna stopped. And the key shaped challah symbolized the key to livelihood, which in God's hand and in our prayers to him, opened the gates of livelihood. So some people even put a key into their challah. So whatever it is, whatever time of year, it's a meaningful, tasty way of starting Shabbos. So Shabbat Shalom. Enjoy Shabbat UK. Best dishes, Denise.
Thanks, Denise. And now it's time for Talmud for Shmerels with Clive Lawton. And this was recorded live at Limud Festival.
Talmud for Shmerels.
So I'd now like to introduce Clive Lawton, who's going to be our Talmud expert in the Talmud for Shmerels.
Well, I can't guarantee you to be an expert, but I'll introduce you to a little bit of Talmud. Listeners may know that there are actually two Talmuds. One that was produced in Babylon is the biggest one, and one that was produced a couple of centuries earlier. It's called the Jerusalem Talmud, but it never went anywhere near Jerusalem, so that's propaganda. It was produced in Galilee, actually. But anyway, and some people call it the Palestinian Talmud, which is really weird because it's got nothing to do with Palestinians. But anyway, this particular story comes up in both Talmuds. In the Babylonian Talmud, it's in a section called Kiddushin. In the Babylonian, in the Jerusalem Talmud, it's a section called Nedarim, but it doesn't matter. What they're discussing, and it's a very common rabbinic discussion, is what is the most important line or the most important rule or the most important teaching in the whole of the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, central bit of stuff for Jews. And two rabbis are in this debate. Anybody who's Christian or has read the New Testament will know a similar discussion in the New Testament. People turn to Jesus and say, what's the most important mitzvah, the most important rule? Jesus, being Jewish, having been asked for one, gives two. He says, all Jews will recognize this. He says, one of them is love God with all your heart and all your soul and all your might. And that comes from Devarim, from Deuteronomy. It comes from the Shema, the prayer, central prayer for Jews. And the other thing he says is, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, which comes from Leviticus 19:18, if you want a reference. And he names these two, love God, love your neighbor. So it's a very common rabbinic discussion. What's important in the Torah? What's the most important thing? And by the way, they can regularly contradict each other and say on one occasion, this is most important. And on the next occasion say, that's most important. Because in the end, they're not trying to prioritize this against that. They're just trying to draw your attention to important things. So on this particular occasion, there are two rabbis having a debate over this. One rabbi is a chap called Rabbi Akiva. Now, he is a heavy-hitting, serious, senior honcho rabbi. And Rabbi Akiva has a lot of credentials. And he is debating with a fellow called Ben Azai. Now, Ben Azai has not got the same status. Frequently, people suggest that Ben Azai was a disciple of Akiva, sometimes a colleague or a companion. But actually, although sometimes Ben Azai is called a rabbi, more properly, he is actually a student. He's given the title of rabbi sometimes, but Akiva's well ahead of him. And so when they're discussing what's the most important line in the whole Torah, Rabbi Akiva says, Ahavta le'arecha kamocha. This is three words. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Ahavta le'arecha kamocha. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Three words. Right? And you can imagine the crowd of Akiva supporters standing around, all waving their scarves, go, yay, Akiva. I mean, that's such a good line, isn't it? I mean, who can possibly defeat this as the best line in the whole Torah? You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now it's Ben Azai's turn, right? This is the underling, the underdog. He's not the favorite in this debate. And Ben Azai says, Ze Sefer Toldot Adam. This means this is the book of the generations of Adam. Now, anybody who's seriously familiar with the Torah will know that this is a line that comes from the book of Bereshit, from Genesis. And it comes just before one of those seriously boring bits of Torah where you start a genealogy. So-and-so begat so-and-so, and so-and-so begat somebody else, and then they died at this age, and then they begat. It's an awful lot of begatting. And there's a whole lot of names of people, and these names have never caught on ever since, and people, you know, just don't call their children Methuselah nowadays. So that's what Ben Azai says. He says this is a greater line than love your neighbor as yourself. It's a greater line is this is the book of the generations of Adam. How obscure is that? Right? And that's effectively where the Talmud leaves it. That's the discussion. Right? Well, did the Ben Azai supporters in the crowd start waving their scarves and go, yay, Ben Azai? Or did they kind of fall back nonplussed, like, well, what is he talking about? I mean, how does that win? But nevertheless, Ben Azai says this is a greater line than love your neighbor as yourself. There are other Jewish rabbinic books. It's not just the Talmud. For example, there are collections of writings called the Midrash, there's a Tanchuma, there's so on and so forth. And in the Midrash Rabbah, there is an explanation. The Midrash Rabbah is a collection of writings about the Torah. And when they come to Bereshit, they're talking about Genesis, and they come to this line, they refer to this debate in the Talmud. And they say, in the Midrash, the reason why Ben Azai was right, and it was a greater concept, is because love your neighbor as yourself has, well, they don't say it in so many words. This is my words. This is the gospel according to Clive, and you all know how you have to treat gospels, okay? But I say this. There are three words in love your neighbor as yourself. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. There are only three problems with this, right? The first problem is you shall love. The second problem is your neighbor. And the third problem is as yourself, right? You shall love. I mean, what does that commandment actually require of you to do? Well, the rabbis are not very interested in kind of nice feelings. What did you do? Your neighbor. Well, that's a relational word, isn't it? It's not everybody. It's certain people, some people, people who you're close to or you connect to, but not everybody. As yourself, that's comparative. It depends how you feel about yourself. As it says in the Midrash, should a man say, because I have been insulted, I can insult others. Because I feel sad, others should feel sad. Whereas the line, this is the book of the generations of Adam, says, all human beings are descended from Adam. Jews, non-Jews, any of them. That Adam was created in the image of God. Therefore, all human beings have a fundamental right to being treated in a dignified and respectful way because it's the image of God. And so what Ben Azai is saying in the Talmud is love your neighbor as yourself is all very well as a starting point. It makes you behave decently to the people around you so long as you feel good about yourself. Whereas this is the book of the generations of Adam means I don't care how you feel about yourself. I don't care who you think you relate to. And I don't even care if you love them. But you must treat them with utter respect. And that, of course, although Ben Azai didn't have the language, is the foundation of the principle of human rights. A bit of Talmud for you.
And that was certainly something I hadn't heard before. Thanks, Clive, and there'll be more from him a little bit later. Now it's time for Gilad Halpin in a section I like to call What Israeli Going On? The original idea for this was that it was going to be about the interesting, slightly quirky stories coming out of the Promised Land. However, there is an election coming up, so we felt that that'll be a bit more interesting until that's all done and dusted in just over a month-ish. Also, there were a couple of issues, meaning there was a choice as to whether I would sound good or Gilad would sound good. And the humble man that I am, I decided that that could be Gilad. Anyway, here you go.
What is really going on?
Quite a lot's happening, isn't it, at the moment within Israel and politics. And we've got the elections in... Very soon, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think that's really a perennial truism when it comes to Israel. It's, you know, it's always an interesting time to be alive in Israel. It gets even more interesting ahead of a general election, which is actually happening for the first time in 4 years, which I think is almost an all-time record. I mean, usually governments don't last until the end of their four-year term. And Netanyahu's government did. And I was seeking re-election and fighting an increasingly uphill battle. Perhaps the most momentous development of the last few days happened last week, but it's really the most momentous in quite a long time, is that it seems, even though it's still uncertain, that there will be a real challenge to Netanyahu's premiership.
Really?
Well, that's why I'm saying it's still uncertain. But I think for the what is likely is that Likud, for the first time in, I don't know, 10 years, will not be the largest party in parliament. not exactly accurate, because in 2009 it wasn't the largest party in parliament yet. Netanyahu became prime minister, but still, he is going to be left behind by this new coalition of centrist parties that were so spectacularly talented until now at not uniting and leaving their electorate scattered and divided. And for some reason, and I have to say that this is something that I certainly did not foresee, they've decided to leave their egos aside and unite behind the newcomer, the former chief of the general staff of the Israel Defense Forces, a gentleman by the name of Benny Gantz, who's pretty tall, almost as tall as I am, but not quite as tall, who's also comes across as a pretty reliable, old-school, uniting character as opposed to Netanyahu's radicalism and divisiveness. And it doesn't seem to be working very well in Gantz's favor, but it seems like there's quite a bit of traction that is getting. And you know, when it comes to the few weeks before people go to the polls, whatever, you know, political consultant or pollster will tell you is that it's all about the trend. And what we are seeing now is perhaps the very early stages, or not, time will tell, of the so-called bandwagon effect, right? That the anti-Netanyahu vote that was divided between several parties, say at least five or six, is slowly starting to coalesce behind one candidate that seems most likely to depose Netanyahu. Now, the problem is that it's not sure that it would work out. Yes, there is a bandwagon effect, and Gantz is breaking through as perhaps the most promising candidate to overtake Netanyahu and Likud, and we're talking about getting at least five or six more seats than Likud. His new party is called Blue and White. You know, couldn't think of a better cliche, but so be it. And the problem is that the devil is really in the details, and the details here are Israel's rather peculiar political system, and that is that no party ever in the history of Israel was a single party of government. More and more minorities, in this case the Jewish minority, is feeling alienated by the Labour Party that had been their political home for so long. That is a scenario that could never happen in Israel, because the people who feel alienated from one party normally have another one to find solace in. This is what's been the defining characteristic of Israeli politics, and it has its downsides, one of which, I think the most major of which, is perhaps the chronic instability of Israeli politics, the fact that coalition government could disintegrate at any given moment. What we're seeing now in this election, and that's actually a pretty interesting development from perhaps, I don't know, a historical or political science point of view, is that we are seeing a return to somewhat two-party system, again with lots of satellite parties around them, but you have one major party that is the party of the right and one major party that is the party of the center, and not so much the left anymore. But you see,
really what there's no big left party. Was it Meretz, right? Is Meretz gone?
No, it's not gone, but it's not big either. It's actually pretty small. Okay. The chances of it being gone exist. You know, some people are more pessimistic than others. I'm not that pessimistic. I think they'll survive. But they're...
but then you thought Netanyahu would be out 2 years ago, so...
No, I didn't. I actually thought that he would... Actually, I started thinking Netanyahu would be out the minute the corruption cases around him began to materialize and bear fruit. It seemed, again, we don't know exactly what's going on there. It's all based on leaks to the press. But it seems like the criminal charges against him are rock solid. Now, whether that would land him in jail or not, only time will tell, because it's...
You recognise how mad that sounds, you know, in terms of, you know, the criminal,
of course,
the criminal case against him is sound, but you know, he'll probably be fine.
I'm not sure. I mean, it's all a question of what kind of plea bargain he would get. I mean, there are many criminals who are walking around free because they agreed to some sort of plea bargain. And of course, the prosecution did as well. So it's all a question of what the prosecution and the attorney general would end up doing. And also, and I always point out this caveat to whoever I speak to, that there is always a chance that there would be some kind of gross miscarriage of justice.
No, never.
No, that's what I'm saying. Well, the Israeli judicial system has proved rather judicious, no pun intended. It's proved to be independent and unbiased and really top-notch in this sense. So many other state apparatuses have been corrupted or been eroded by outside pressure that you don't quite know what will happen now. So it's not completely off the table, but I really still have faith in Israel's court system. The discussion around the coming elections is basically temporary because the Attorney General will probably be recommending to indict Netanyahu. He's likely to release a statement to this effect later this week. And if all goes well, I mean, it depends again, well for whom, there will probably be an indictment in a year's time. Now, the question is, what happens until then and after that? Because if the Attorney General says there would be an indictment, so it's pretty ironclad, right? The Prime Minister is going to be charged. Now, of course, the presumption of innocence is always and still valid to everybody, including the Prime Minister. So, I mean, you can't really convict him yet, but criminally, but what does it mean politically? Will his coalition partners and even his own, you know, his collaborators in his own party, will they just act as if nothing had happened? And, you know, as long as the Prime Minister is not fully convicted of X, Y, and Z crimes, will he still be able to continue acting as Prime Minister? The issue is that he was probably, and that it is what the police have said and the Attorney General, the prosecution, are likely to follow suit, is that he has received bribes knowingly. And that is a much more serious charge. Now, what do the Israelis say about that? I think the short answer is that there's no such thing as the Israelis, right? It's almost 9 million different people with 9 million different opinions. But largely, it is divided, interestingly, according to party lines. Netanyahu's supporters seem to not care too much about the fact that he's charged with taking bribes. And Netanyahu's detractors care a lot about it. In his brilliant biography of Netanyahu, the Haaretz journalist Anshul Pfeffer calls him a Marmite politician. You either love him or hate him. And I think that's also true to everything that is that Netanyahu is involved in. His foreign policy, his domestic policy, his demeanor. I mean, the way that he treats people who, you know, disagree with him. This is exactly what happened in Netanyahu's case, the so-called 4000 case, that he eased telecommunication regulations for a telecommunication mogul who was also the proprietor of one of the largest news sites in the country in return for favorable coverage. So as long as you see a systematic connection between the two, and to the extent of what I hear, the prosecution has been able to substantiate that systematic connection, then it becomes clear that a bribery is involved here.
Wow.
How is that going to affect Netanyahu's prospects? Probably not very much, because it has become pretty clear, as I said, that he's really up to his eyeballs in those corruption charges. The due process is that the police investigate the so-called crimes and then sends a recommendation to the prosecution, I mean, together with all their findings. And that recommendation is not binding, but still it's something, because it's based on however many months of investigation. And they said that there are clear charges of corruption, of bribery. I mean, that his culpability is pretty obvious. That happened a few months ago. And even though it's not binding, it normally is picked up to a certain extent by the prosecution. And now we see that this is probably what's going to happen. And if that hasn't really affected Netanyahu's popularity until now, I don't know how much this week's statement by the Attorney General will. But again, as I said, when the indictment is finally handed down, and we're talking a few months down the line, the question is to what extent it would embroil Netanyahu politically. I mean, to what extent his coalition partners and his supporters within his own party would agree to remain in his cabinet and act as if nothing had happened. And also, to what extent it would embroil him legally, because there is a precedent that was set a few years ago. Sadly, or thankfully, Israel is not short of corrupt and convicted politicians. So a few years ago, a minister who's now back in the government after having served jail time, a gentleman by the name of Aryeh Deri, who's a Haredi politician, the leader, one of the actually founders of Shas, was indicted and subsequently convicted of bribery, and as I said, imprisoned as well. And when he was indicted, he was cabinet minister. So there was a high court petition that sought to rule that a defendant could not serve as a cabinet minister, and that was upheld by the High Court of Justice, and they actually forced Aryeh Deri to resign when that happened. The thing is that it applies to cabinet ministers and not to a prime minister that has a separate status. So the question is, can a person not be, a defendant not be a cabinet minister for all it says about the rule of law in Israel, but a prime minister can? So I expect there to be high court petitions just the same, and it also remains to be seen what the High Court of Justice would rule on that. Even if he does win the coming general election, which is a likely possibility, his potential coalition partners outnumber the potential coalition partners of Benny Gantz and his new centrist Blue and White party. So even if Blue and White come in first, they will have to muster a majority in parliament.
So if you're a betting man then, what would you put the odds of Blue and White managing to pull it off and becoming the party of government come April?
I would say about 20%.
Ooh, I was expecting more than that. Interesting. So you think that it's very likely that Likud is going to hold on?
It is very likely. I actually think that 20% is pretty good compared to what it was before. Just before the 2015 elections, I thought the odds were a lot smaller. And then suddenly in 2013, that Netanyahu just, you know, swam through the election to victory.
Wow. So I think we're all going to be awaiting with interest. I think like everything else in the world at the moment, no one has any idea what's actually going to happen, which is both.
Yeah, well, that's the beauty of politics, isn't it? Or you know, it gives you, it's just like one big reality show.
It's not like, it is, right?
Yeah, yeah, with all the eccentric characters and the mudslinging and, you know, the unexpected result.
Wow. Gilad Halpern, thank you so, so much. And I look forward to hearing from you next time.
I look forward to it again. Thank you, Hayden.
And from Tel Aviv all the way back to London, I went to the JQ Wingate Literary Prize. Before I get into it, let's hear from head judge Shoshana Boyd-Gelfand.
Well, as you can imagine, this was an incredibly difficult decision. It was incredibly difficult just getting to these six books and then deciding on an actual winner. No place to lay one's head. I can't give you a good reason why this one won and not these ones, because actually all of them we felt were very worthy of winning. But the fact that after incredible debate, this one won, I would say there is something so redemptive about this book. This was a book about a woman who opened a bookshop in Berlin. And how appropriate, this many years after her death, the book has been found. It has been translated, and someone who loved literature so much is the winner of this prize.
So that was the winner of the JQ Wingate Prize being announced. And I'd just like to say the event held at JW3 was fantastic. All six books were discussed in just enough detail without getting boring, and the short extracts read out by an actor provided enough to whet my appetite to want to read them all in their entirety. Now to the winner. No Place to Lay One's Head by Françoise Frenkel, written in 1945 after going through the war, trying to open a bookshop in 1930s Germany. It sounds like a gripping read. The book fended off competition from a 13-strong long list and 6-book short list, which is extremely impressive for a writer who died in 1975. In fact, the only reason it was eligible for the prize was because it's been recently translated into English. It does raise some interesting thoughts, though. Should a writing prize be for the living? Does a literary prize exist to award artistic merit only, or should consideration be put into the commercial ramifications? As a writer has no living relatives, should a publisher and translator, who it should be noted also do work hard, receive the accolades and remunerations? Maybe there could be a special prize for writers who are no longer with us, so we can honour their work whilst leaving the main award to acknowledge living talent. Just some thoughts. I'll let you draw your own conclusions, which is something you don't need to do with Julia Gazdag, as she'll tell you what to do instead. Here's Julia.
Dear Julia, both my mother and my mother-in-law want to come on family vacation with us, but one likes to pamper herself and stay in a nice hotel, and the other is less particular and likes to schedule every second. I don't want either of them coming with us. What do I do? As someone with both a mother and a mother-in-law, what do you say?
Well, I'm very lucky in that my mother and my mother-in-law are, they get on very well and their vacation styles are very compatible. Shut up, Aiden. It's not my fault. I got lucky with my family. I would not tell them I'm going on vacation. And then
they come round and they go, oh, come round, I've brought you some, you know,
no,
food.
No, I would not tell them we're going on vacation. And then at the last minute say, oh, my husband just got a week off work. So we planned it last minute. We're really sorry. We thought it would be too stressful for you. And just, you know, whatever you need to do, like lie.
What I'm saying is lie.
Lie your face off because it's more important.
But isn't there something nice about a family? Isn't there something nice about having a family holiday? Shouldn't you maybe, you know, push through and go, okay, fine, it might be a bit awkward, but at the same time, we might have a bonding experience. It might not be as bad. It might not be as bad as we think.
I'm going to assume that the person who submitted this question knows their family and knows their boundaries.
Do we ever
and
truly know someone, though, you know?
You might not. No, I'm going to assume that this question is valid. I tend to assume all our questions are valid. And yeah.
I'm not questioning the validity of the question, just to clarify.
I know.
I'm not.
Yeah, I think there's no reason to hurt people's feelings, but also there's no reason to take a family vacation, which, you know, it costs time, it costs money, if you're describing a family vacation, I'm assuming you have children, so that's already a stress factor. You're already not going to get to do what you want to do. You're going to be dragged in as many directions as you have children plus your spouse. And so to add on top of that, two grandparents with completely different needs who need those needs met, and I'm just going to keep saying the word need 10 times in a sentence. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's a lot, and I completely understand wanting to get out of that, but you also don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. And
so lie. So lie. The moral of the story,
yeah,
lie.
Absolutely. Lie.
And what a moral to take. Julia Gazdag, thank you very much.
Anytime.
And from avoiding a broigus to an actual broigus, it's now time for the bagel broigus.
The bagel broigus.
So this is the second bagel broigus on whether the Jewish community should air its dirty linen in public. I'm joined by Clive Lawton, who is an OBE for his work within Jewish education. Is that fair?
Well, actually, general education and Limud.
Okay.
Two things.
Okay. Great. Ben just pumped his fist.
I saluted when he said general education.
Ah, fantastic. Fantastic. And Ben Crown, who is a forensic accountant and runs the Better Know a Jewish Charity blog, which some could argue does. It's dated in public anyway, but we'll get onto that in a second. And Marie van der Zyl, who is the president of the Board of Deputies. Thank you all very, very much for joining me this morning in this makeshift studio, which I think is quite nice. I quite like it.
Nice. Mm. Yeah. Cozy.
Yeah. So I thought we'd start just because I think it's quite a nice way to start with Clive, because I know you've got a lot of experience as a trustee of about a million different charities, right? Do you want people to know what's going on behind the scenes, or do you like a bit of opaqueness?
I like people to know what's going on. And it's not nosiness, because, frankly, I don't want anybody to know what's going on in my home and my family and, you know, what I earn and whether I spend that money this way or that. That's my private business, and I've got every right to do what I will with the money that I've got. But the money we're talking about are, to some degree, well, they are public monies. If Mr. Moneybags says, I'm going to set up a foundation and I'm going to put £1 million into it and I want to spend this on charitable causes, well, good luck to the bloke. I mean, I'm really pleased that he does it, and that's fabulous. But once he starts utilising the structures of charitable giving and thereby asking the government to tax relief the money that he's putting there, effectively taking our tax pounds and using it for his donations, then I think the public has an interest.
But that's an interesting distinction, right? So that there's what you're saying seems to fall into the legalistic responsibility, you know, and the fact that it has to be publicly accountable.
Yes, it's more than legal. It's ethical. If somebody is using public money, yours and mine, the government's, the country's, if they are using it to spend on things that they believe are important, there are two things that the public has a right to wonder about. One, is it important? Should they be spending my money on it? And secondly, are they? Are they doing it honestly? Or are they actually, you know, making themselves a house with marble and columns on the doors and stuff under the pretext that they're running a charity?
It's interesting, but at the same time, I think that the crux of this debate is the numerous controversies that, say, the Jewish community has, and there's plenty of those, right? But
Sorry, Hedden, can I just interrupt you there? Because there aren't plenty of those. I mean, there's a huge amount. And let's get it into perspective, because I think it is important that we do, to use your initial phrase, air our dirty linen in public and so on. I think it's very important, but it's also important that the community gets this into some kind of perspective. There's a huge number of Jewish charities doing masses of really good work, and trustees giving inordinate amounts of time and volunteers and, you know, fabulous stuff going on. And there are, from time to time, scandals and revelations and discoveries and stuff. And it's important that those things, I think, are exposed. But it would be very sad if we got into the situation of people saying, well, there's no point in giving to charity, they're all a bunch of crooks. I think that would be unfair.
Fair point. Yeah. Fair point. I just want to kind of get to this point beyond the money, right? So the money is important, for sure. But in terms of any of the, and I accept, and thank you, Clive, for calling me out on it, the limited number of controversies that are there. Let's even give us, I think, one really good example. And
I think we tell too many stories about individuals and not enough stories about organisations.
I think that's a very fair point. I think every organisation needs to have its policies and procedures and be open to scrutiny. So if an organisation doesn't have policies and procedures, an individual may or may not be at fault.
Right.
Because it depends what they're required to do, what authorities they're required to get, and how the internal procedures are reviewed and audited. The Board of Deputies, it's not just people on our committees checking what we spend, it's how we spend it on and what we spend it on, because we are very conscious that individuals give us £30 a year, every member of the shul, for the communal levy, and it's our duty to spend the money wisely. We have to be democratic, accountable and transparent, and we want to have everybody having absolute confidence that our organisation is there and it does what it says it's going to do, and we're genuinely committed to the community. And once we have got everybody's money, it's a real trust in us to spend it wisely. We've got an absolute duty to make sure that everybody knows that that is our priority. We are very, very scrutinised at the Board of Deputies of British Jews. We've got committees, subcommittees, and that's the best way. That's the best and only way to be in a position of responsibility, so that the community has confidence as us as leaders.
I still feel like we're circling around it. I don't know. I feel like there's something that we're not attacking. I don't know. Like this Let's get to the concept of you know, Doug Murray shit, right? How we're all supposed to be kind of a light unto the nations, right? This idea that as Jews, as a Jewish community, we are, maybe it's our communal arrogance, but we feel that we are supposed to be better and our moral standards are high. I feel like it's fair to say that is a perception within the community, that our moral standards are high.
Well, then, Hayden, we're riding for a fall, right? If we want to pretend that the Jews are somehow more virtuous than other people, we're just going to get ourselves into trouble. What we should be doing as a Jewish community is we should be a model of having the right kinds of checks and balances on what we do. We all know that money is a dreadful corrupter. I think that everybody who's using charitable money has a responsibility to think, what is reasonable to ask from the charity? What can I defend if it became public, if somebody asked the question? Everybody who works for an organization has that responsibility, but the trustees have a responsibility to ensure that everybody in the organization has a policy and an understanding as to what they can spend and can't spend, and that's enforced. But I think the trouble is, and where it really gets difficult, and where the history is, I think, an awful lot of Jewish charities are the personal pets of very wealthy folk. Somebody gives huge amounts of money, and bless them for doing so, otherwise we'd all be in trouble.
Absolutely.
Somebody gives huge amounts of money to something, and therefore it's not surprising that they start to feel they own it. It's theirs. And why can they not make a decision about what happens and how it goes and so on? So even if there is some constitutional structure whereby decisions have to be made, scrutiny has to happen, they think, oh, come on, you know, it's my £1 million, or I paid £500,000, or why can't my cousin get a job in that organisation, or whatever it might be. And of course, for a very long time, that was exactly how it was, a Victorian philanthropic model. But we now have a requirement for open access, and they are taking government money insofar as they get tax relief on this process. And in so doing, they then make themselves publicly accountable. If they don't want to do that, and then take £1 million out of their pocket, already taxed, and they spend that on what they like, nobody can question them. But if they say, I want tax relief on this, so give me another £250,000 so I can spend £1.25 million, then at that point, they're saying, I've got to be answerable to the public.
I think we've got to go further than that. Even if it's not public funds, even if it's funds from individuals, a charity is not a private company to run as you want. It's a charity, and you've got to have regard to the charitable objectives in your role as a trustee. And that's why it's very, very, very important that we're all open to scrutiny.
Can I ask a question of Ben? Because I mean, Ben's been looking at charities for a long time now. And is there some kind of pattern or trap or problem that the ones that are problematic fall into?
I think the real problem is, I mean, yes, I think it's along the lines that you alluded to before. Organizations are made up of individuals, and it's very easy for the individuals at the top of an organization not to make a distinction between what's in their personal interest in all cases and what's in the organization's personal interest. And something which, say, would be embarrassing to an individual if it was revealed might be covered up or moved aside or whatever, even though it would be the interest of the organization or of the community more generally for it to be known, for it to be disclosed and discussed openly, that this tension between the charity, which is there to serve its beneficiaries, and the people who are actually making decisions at the charity, and the conflation between personal interests and public interests and charitable interests, realize at the core of almost all the major scandals, the major concerning events that have happened in community in the last few years.
So you're saying you don't come across outright dishonesty much? It's rather more that confusion as to responsibility or something.
I mean, there are crooks in the world, and there are people who are corrupt, and you can set up structures to police that. I speak professionally. You never be going to be able to eliminate fraud or eliminate theft. What you can do is build structures which allow you to hold people accountable if they've been caught, to reassure people about trust in the charitable sector, which we know nationally is an all-time low. And if you don't do those things, if you do what's expedient in the moment, then you're just saving up trouble for the future.
But in the context of having a leadership role and being a leader in the Jewish community, I think it's very important that any leader has to set an example.
To come back to your very first question, which is, should we wash our dirty linen in public? I think we may be in danger of suggesting that this leadership thing is perfectly straightforward. Right? We've got the rules, we know what we're doing, and that's open, honest, public, transparent, and so forth. I do understand that instinct when you care for the reputation of your organization and a scandal blows up. You think that if this comes out, my organization, whatever it is, school, charity, whatever it is, which is doing good, which people love, which gets public support and stuff like that, I'm going to damage it or destroy it. So why don't we just make this go away? If we just make rules and say, well, that's wrong and you must do something else, people will continue to circumvent it because they will continue to feel that they should try and enable their organization to survive. If they understood the truth of the matter, which is, first, if this ever does come out, be twice as bad. Second, you are not protecting your organization by doing these things in the long run, because you're creating then a dishonest organization, which can't be trusted, whose staff are dodgy and nobody knows, or whatever the issue might be, that in the long run, you are damaging your organization, although it may not seem so.
An organization might also be at fault. They may not have the evidence to follow through. Their procedures might not have been good enough. They may have turned a blind eye to things. So it could be for a whole combination of things.
Is there a line? For example, I may or may not have taken a box of pens from a previous job, right? Let's say, in an ethical and moral, they're amazing pens that I definitely didn't take. That if that is something that on an ethical and moral level, you could argue that maybe I hypothetically, if I did do that, shouldn't have done. But it's not.
It's just giving the problem to someone else. That's not right. I think that if an employer knows that there's wrongdoing,
but that's a box of pens, right? So it's something that's clearly.
I have to write in your reference? Hayden Cohen is an excellent fellow, has done a fine job of work, but I do need to mention that there was an occasion when he took a box of pens. Do I need to say that? And thereby damage your employment profile because of a comparatively small misdemeanor.
Right.
Yeah. No, not a small misdemeanor. If there's a serious concern in the workplace, then maybe an employer won't give a reference at all. If you think there is wrongdoing and we won't know terms of settlement, why would an employer then pay that person?
Yes.
So let me ask a question to
you. As a forensic accountant, you may have looked into these issues, Ben.
Well, I guess let me ask you both a question, which is, let's say you catch someone with their hand in the till. Mm-hmm. Let's just make it purely about money, and the person's going to be fired, and he's set. And on the one hand, you want the money back, but on the other hand, there's a reputation of the organisation to consider. And the guy says, "Look, if you take me to court, you know, there's evidence. If you take me to court, I will be compelled to pay, but it's public. So I propose to give you half, and it's less hassle for you, and we sign a non-disclosure, and you never tell anyone. And so it's for the good of the organization that you get some of the money back, but my reputation is preserved. Is that a reasonable thing to do?"
Well, from my point of view, I don't think I would ever sign a non-disclosure statement in that instance. I'm not going to limit my right to say what happened, should I be called upon to do so. Whether I would accept a deal, which is, look, I'll give you half the money back, and that'll be that, I think I probably would weigh up for the organisation. If we're trying to take this chap to court, it could cost us a lot. We might not get through it. I'm using charitable money to do that too. So maybe if I get the £500 out of the 1,000 instead of spending £6,000 on chasing him, that might be the case. And if I can just say, because I can see that Marie wants to come in. But I would also say that there is a matter of humanity in this. If this fellow has been an employee or loyal servant of the organization for quite a while, and something's gone wrong in the last 6 months where, after all these years, he's put his hand in the till, he's taken this money, there is a level of humanity. There's judgment and there's mercy. Should be an element of grace in dealing with people. And I'm not trying to fudge the moral responsibility of the trustees. But the moral responsibility goes on every level of ethics, not just ruthless clarity on getting money back.
I have to say that there is no excuse, in my view, for employees to steal from an employer, whatever the circumstances. But in relation to asking for the money back, you have to also remember that if something is reported to the police may be concerned that the investigation that could be conducted by the police is being interfered with. And in my experience, if I think there is financial wrongdoing. I myself would get the information together. I'd get an investigatory report and I'd give that to the employee with the evidence so that it's quite clear that there is wrongdoing. You have the responsibility as an organisation for investigating it properly and so that you understand the full extent of it and that is put and that the employee has an opportunity to answer allegations in these situations. But employees can't take money that doesn't belong to them, whatever the circumstances. We all may go through difficult times, but that isn't an excuse.
Yes, they must be called to account and they must be punished, whatever that is, whether it's losing the job or paying the money back, whatever it might be. But the question is, to what degree do you crush them? So, for example, if the sum of money is not a large sum of money, do you take this to the police? Do you drag their reputation through the courts? Do you do all of those things? Or do you say, this is not the greatest sin in the world? It's wrong. It must be punished. They lose their job, whatever it may be. But I'm not going to take this to its full extent. Or do you say, everybody's got to know that in this organization, there's a zero tolerance thing. Anybody seen taking a box of pens? Let's not worry about taking any money. A box of pens, it's reported
to
hypothetical box of pens. It goes to the police and that's all there is to it and let the justice system take its course.
Between a company where you might be able to take that decision, it's your company as a director, and a charity where you are a trustee and you've got different fiduciary duties, I think, as a trustee. You can't make that sort of decision that you're going to cover it up.
No, well, I don't, I'm not.
Because you're a charitable trustee, it's not the same as, Ben will tell us about his experience as a private limited company where you decide to take that decision.
You have to investigate. Obviously, you have to investigate your motives. And if you're covering it up is one thing. If you're dealing with the issue is something else. There are two different, they may look very similar from the outside, but there may be two very different motivations. You have to investigate your motivation. And while I take that Maria is an employment lawyer, and I think that the contract of employment between folk is the basis on which that relationship exists, I think very often, especially in charities and sometimes in public administration as well, people give above and beyond the nature of the job because of their love for the job, their concern for it, and so on. And I think in charities especially, there is an understandable desire to have humane relationship with employees, which may not exist in normal commercial employment environment. And that then goes all the way to the line when things go horribly wrong. That level of humanity, which I think is frequently part of how people give so much of themselves to charities, has to be played into how one resolves these things.
The reason why investigations are also important is because if there hasn't been a proper investigation and allegations are made about employees in public, their lives could be ruined. Whereas if there had been a proper investigation and it was the responsibility of the employer for not having proper processes and procedures and they hadn't done anything wrong, look at the impact it could also have on the employee through huge publicity. And that isn't justice either, is it?
No, I accept that.
I think I just sort of have one final thought here, which we were talking about. We're making a distinction between, you know, the original action, the original offence, what that might be, the institutional reaction and the institutional response. And in certain contexts, it's right to make the distinction, but I think there's a sense in which these are not two different things. These are two aspects of the same thing, which is an environment which is inclined towards covering things up and brushing things on the carpet and not correctly dealing with problems is a cultural environment which is going to have these problems come back.
Well, it's important to see if it's changed. Yes.
If people think they can steal, more people will steal. If there's an embedded, and we see so often in the last year or so, when there's an embedded culture of sexual harassment, when organisations don't police that behaviour, especially when it comes from the top, it becomes endemic throughout an organisation and no individual, when it happens again, when it happens to them, is able to take action because the system itself is guilty.
Yes. Not fully accepted.
As an employment lawyer, I deal with many, many of those allegations. Absolutely. And it all comes back to leadership, confidence. But we have to have consistency of values as well. And we have to live our values. And we also, as Clive said, you have to be fair to people as well. So covering things up without a proper investigation and then publicising if someone's done this terrible wrongdoing also has a terrible and permanent effect on that person's life.
Right. And I think that's actually a good point to end on, this idea that at the end of all of this, we are dealing with individuals.
Yes.
And we have to think carefully about the impact of that whilst also making sure that everyone's held accountable. Can we all agree? Is that the consensus that we've got?
Yes. We're dealing with individuals. We must be humane and decent about that and fair. Mm. But when we're talking about community organisations, community funds and community endeavours and dreams, we have a responsibility to be very, very clear about the values underpinning those things and the value-based decisions that we will make for the good of the organisation, which is frequently to expose it to challenge at times in order to ensure that its culture doesn't become corrupt. And the desire sometimes to keep it clean, to keep things quiet, ultimately corrupts the organisation. And that's why I think it's very important that people who feel that they're doing the right thing, who are trying to help their organisation, are reminded that this, in the long run, does great damage to them.
And we have to remember what we're all doing this for. We're doing this for the benefit of the community, not actually for the organisation. Well, the Board of Deputies, we represent the wider Jewish community, and the Jewish community comes first and above the organisation, and that is where our duty lies.
Ben Crown, Marie van der Zyl and Clive Lawton, thank you so much for your time. If you have any future ideas for Bagel Bruges's, please, or anything for the Bagel Podcast, please email oi@bagelpodcast.com. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you.
And that is an open offer, by the way. Do get in touch. You can get in touch on bagelpodcast.com. You can get in touch on Facebook, on Twitter. It's all the Bagel Podcast stuff. Just find me, say hello. I want to hear from you. Anything and everything. Until next time, thanks for listening and Shalom Aleichem.